Hello and welcome to Season 4 of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. We're back for a new season with 14 fantastic guests lined up ready to share their lives and insights. Plus, we've got a brand new game to play to test their Somerset knowledge to the limits. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is an advocate and evangelist for one of nature's most transient and poetic displays, the humble cloud. Gavin Preter-Pinney founded the Cloud Appreciation Society around 15 years ago after a career in the creative industries. He has united tens of thousands of people around the world with a passion for clouds. Along with this global community, he has also written books on the subject and spoken to a wide range of audiences, from literary festivals to TED Talks. We met earlier this month at Gavin's home in Somerton and started the podcast in a slightly unusual way, by doing a bit of cloud spotting ourselves. So why not take a moment while you listen to look up and do your own daydreaming? Gavin, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Hi, great to be with you.
You're joining me, or I'm joining you, just outside Somerton in a glorious late summer or early autumn evening. And I was just saying that usually I will start by asking guests a couple of warm-up questions, I suppose, but we will spend a lot of time talking about clouds, and we're surrounded by just some beautiful clouds at the moment. So I thought we could just start by not just looking, but maybe describing what it is that's in the sky above us at the moment. You can probably guide me through some of this. So where would you start on an afternoon like this?
Totally. Well, we've got a real range of clouds to look at today. It's perfect setup, really, for us to chat about clouds. And I can tell you about a few of them if you'd like.
Sure.
So perhaps the most dominant ones in the sky today are, they're like the generic cloud. They're called cumulus clouds. And they're these white, puffy ones with kind of cauliflower tops to them. Quite solid looking. And that's what the name in Latin means. It's a stack or a heap, cumulus. Like an accumulation. That's what we get that word from. These are low, clumpy clouds made of water droplets. Fair weather, happy clouds, see them on a sunny day. They're the Simpson clouds. So that's what we've got a bunch of around. You can see off in the distance there, they've got quite flat bases compared to their kind of bumpy cauliflower tops, which is one of the distinctive features of them. Now, in contrast to those, we've got some high clouds today as well. These are the far wispier ones off in the distance there, which look like brush strokes across the blue. And those are known as cirrus clouds, named after the Latin for a lock of hair. Cirrus is a curl or a lock of hair. And those ones are made of ice crystals. And they are much higher in the sky than those cumulus. Known as high clouds, they are the highest of the 10 main types of clouds, cirrus are. So those are the two dominant ones, but we've got a bunch of others going on as well. Do you want me to just carry on taking
yeah,
through
absolutely.
Them?
Well, I was going to ask the sort of the difference in, you talked about the cirrus being a lot higher than the cumulus. The sort of, it's quite hard to judge the distance from down where we are.
Yeah, so clouds all happen in a part of our atmosphere known as the troposphere. It's the lower region of our atmosphere, and how high that is and therefore how high these clouds are varies depending on where you are in the world and on the season as well. But the troposphere goes from the ground up to around maybe 12 kilometers 14 kilometers, 8-10 miles. And yet if you're near the tropics, it's higher, and if you're near the poles, it's lower. So when it comes to the exact altitude, we tend to be a bit vague about it when we're talking about clouds. We just divide that part, that weather part of our atmosphere, the troposphere, divided up into low, middle and high sort of regions. And we put the clouds into low clouds, mid-level clouds and high clouds. So those high cirrus, they're up about, around about the cruising altitude of an aircraft, something like that. And they might be 6, 7, 8 miles up, something like that. Those ice crystals that they're made of is why they have the kind of translucent effect. And those ice crystals are cascading from the upper reaches of the troposphere. And as they fall, they pass through differing winds, speeding up or slowing down, maybe becoming thicker in as they fall through air that's got more moisture in it, and maybe thinning out if they fall through air that's a bit drier. And that's why the cirrus clouds have this brush stroked appearance, or appearing like kind of straight hair flowing through water. Now, look over there behind you. You can see high clouds that are more clumpy. They are way up, but they're made a little kind of bits. And those you would call, they're like up at the cirrus level, but they're not long strands, a curl of hair. You'd call those cirrocumulus. A bit like the clumpy ones down near here, which look big because they're close, but those ones are a long way up, and so we call them at the cirrus level, they're cirrocumulus. And those have got holes in them. Can you see the holes? Mm-hmm. Those are known as lacunosus. It's a Latin for full of holes. And it's when just a patch of air has sinking pockets of air, which shape the appearance of the cloud. Also, there's some kind of waves, they're like in ridges, that be known as undulatus. So cirrocumulus clouds up there with some of these features going on.
It's sort of like an animal print.
Yeah, like a leopard print or
like
something
like that. Like a leopard skin kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then just before we, just to round up the kind of descriptions.
So I want to test my memory of learning about clouds at school. So the ones just, that's Coombe Hill over there. So just beyond the sort of grey, flattish ones.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's stratus.
Yes. Well, yes and maybe no.
Okay.
Stratus is indeed right for a layer of clouds. And those ones could be described as alto stratus. Alto is a term for when clouds are in the middle level. It sounds like high, but we call cirro clouds up high. We don't have a kind of an addition to the word when they're low clouds, but the middle ones we have alto at the start. So alto stratus or alto cumulus. Those are at the alto level, but you know what? I would be slightly reluctant to call that alto stratus, which is just a kind of like fog up in the middle level. Alto stratus is that kind of overcast sky that is really like the boring cloud, really, alto stratus. It's just a kind of grey sky that's overcast. Those to me look a little bit more like a formation known as lenticularis. And lenticularis is named after the Latin for a lentil. When clouds have a kind of disc-like appearance to them, sometimes those discs are kind of more joined up, and that's what is going on, I think, over there. You've got sort of lozenges joining together, discs joining together. The lentil-shaped cloud, so really the Latin for little lens, but that's what the Romans used to call lentils. They look like UFOs often, these clouds, flying saucers. And those are as a result of air flowing over raised terrain like hills or mountains many miles away, can set up these waves in the flow of the air with these clouds forming at the crests of these invisible waves. I think that's what you got going on down there, lenticularis clouds joined together.
Beautiful.
But stratus, I mean, there's an element of stratus to them because they're kind of, they're in a layer, you're right.
I think it was only the basics that I can just about remember from that time. But yeah, it's a really good day for it. And I think we'll go on to talk about sort of your passion and sort of the contagious nature of that, I suppose, a little bit later on. So as I mentioned before, we're just outside of Somerton. It's a very historic part of the county, isn't it?
Yeah. Right in the middle of Somerset, and market town, Somerton, ancient capital of Wessex. No, it's a beautiful place, quite near to the levels. So you're near to, we're not on the levels here, but quite near to the levels. So that's always an interesting kind of region of the county for the sky, because, you know, it's quite broad expanse there with not so many obstacles. And then of course we have not far from here Glastonbury, where you have the Tor sticking up out of the kind of level ground, or perhaps a bit further away Borough Mump, something like that, a Borough Bridge, where again you've got a sort of abrupt hill sticking out of the levels. And those are great spots for looking at the sky, because you kind of get elevated within an environment that invites you to look up because of its flatness.
There's something quite compelling about seeing clouds from closer to them or even above them. You talked earlier about cruising heights of planes. Mm. And I've always been, you know, fascinated and amazed and sort of elated that moment that you emerge on the other side of the cloud. So it can be, you know, the greyest day in the UK, and in a plane you're sort of above it all. Mm. And you know, you're looking down on this almost like a landscape.
It's like a moment of revelation when your plane bursts out through that layer, and what seemed quite indistinct below, without many features perhaps this would be a cloud known as stratocumulus, which is like cumulus part, these individual clumps here, and the stratas you were talking about before combined together, you've got a clumpy layer. Mm. That clumpy layer may be unbroken, so it may be covering the whole sky. So beneath it, it's just like a slight variation of greys. Burst through it in a plane, and up above you have a landscape of cloud. You have a terrain of shifting, moving geology of the atmosphere, with the sun casting shadows across the peaks and down over the valleys of this shifting terrain. It is magical, and it is something I remember really strongly first going in an aircraft and looking out the window and realizing that, okay, whatever's down here below, the sun's shining on top of it. And that was a weird revelation to have. And it's true, viewing clouds from above or up at their level gives a whole new perspective on them, which is kind of fascinating, I find.
Coming back down to Earth then, and more specifically your family and your upbringing, I know your family's been connected with this area for quite some time, hasn't it? Can you tell me a bit more about that?
My dad is from around here, from Somerset, and grew up around Somerton, so they just live up the road. My brother's family is 5 minutes away, my sister's family is 7 minutes away, so us three didn't actually grow up in London, in Somerset. We grew up in London, but my parents have always had some fields and this wood down here, and they built the house they're in the early 70s, and we would come down for weekends throughout our youth. And then about 15 or 16 years ago, we did up this barn that we live in now, which used to be a derelict barn and used to be a kind of cow shed, really. So we did that up, and it's really nice to be around the rest of the family and nearby to each other.
Yeah. Am I also right in thinking that sort of beyond just that one previous generation, there's an additional history, and there might be a former mayor of Bristol as an ancestor?
Yeah, that's right. Pinnies, lots of Pinnies in the West Country generally, in Dorset. There's a Bristol connection. There's all across the West Country you'll find Pinnies, yeah. So, yeah.
You mentioned that you grew up in London then. Did you sort of consider yourself a city city boy growing up?
I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, I like the stimulation of being in a city. And actually, funnily enough, you know, cloud spotting doesn't have to be done, and being engaged in the sky doesn't have to be done out in the country. Within an urban environment, the sky's the last wilderness within easy reach. And you can, you know, that's one of the appeals of the sky, is that it's easily accessible no matter where you are. And so, yeah, growing up in London, I loved the excitement of being in London. I loved the culture. Now I'm in a different phase. Now I kind of appreciate the rhythm of the year, the seasons more. And you are divorced from that kind of that shifting time scale when you are in the middle of a city. You know what I mean? So you don't get quite such a visceral impression of the year, the progress of the year within a city, just because of the urban environment, you know.
Growing up then, you mentioned your siblings. Were there lots of differences between you kind of in those early years?
Actually, we've always got on really well. We're very different, but we have always been on really good terms with each other and don't kind of fall out. My brother's like in the world of finance, which is like very different from me. My sister, perhaps a bit more similar in the sense she was a yoga teacher and ran a yoga center. And so I ended up being in the creative industries. So I guess we were all doing quite different things, but always, we've got on. I mean, we're not kind of siblings where there are rivalries or tensions or anything like that. We've all gotten pretty well, which I guess is testament to my parents, really, ultimately.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
When I was really young, I wanted to drive a tractor. I remember somebody asking me when I was really young, and that's what I said. But then also when I was really young, my mum said when she was driving me into school in London, that I looked out the window one time. I don't remember this really, but I looked out the window and there was a sunlight bursting from behind a big puffy cloud. And there were those beams, you know, those beams of sunlight. I now know they're called crepuscular rays. At the time, she said I was just talking to her about it. And I said something like it was like thunder, but you couldn't hear it or something like that. And it just stuck in her mind that I had been particularly interested in that. So, but when it came to sort of what I was going to be when I grow up, yeah, I mean, the idea of driving a tractor was quite good in my mind. But then as I grew older, I was interested in science at school. I got really kind of geeky in science and did double maths and physics and chemistry and sort of physics S level and maths S level and really kind of went with that. And then ended up doing philosophy at university and psychology. And then it was really, all went in a bit of a circle because I did ultimately think coming out of university, it was going to be quite hard to get a job with philosophy. So then I got into doing graphic design. And that's how I worked initially as an art director and graphic designer. But I remember after university, I did an MA in graphic design at Central St. Martin's in London. I remember the guys saying to me at the end of the course, you know, they sort of sit down and talk to you about what you're going to maybe do next in your job. And they always say, you know, so-and-so, you maybe should get a job in a kind of design agency or this and that. And then when they came to me, they said, we really have no idea what you're going to do. You're going to have to find your own sort of way and maybe create your own job for yourself in some way, because, you know, having done philosophy and psychology and then going into design and they weren't and being sciencey, being into writing but also into design, they were like, I don't know how all that's going to fit together, but you're going to have to work it out for yourself.
Just a few years into that career then, you founded a magazine called The Idler. What's the story behind that?
I did that with a friend of mine called Tom Hodgkinson, and we were at school together, so we've known each other a long time. After starting out as a designer, freelance designer, I've been working for this, that, and the other various, I've done various magazines at university, and so I knew a thing or two about putting together the kind of visual side of magazines. And Tom, my friend from school, wanted to start a magazine that he really was, he'd been inspired by Samuel Johnson and the writing of Samuel Johnson about the importance of leisure time. And this was late 90s, we're talking about here, quite some time back, when work-life balance wasn't a phrase, and when it was early 90s. It was early 90s. Work-life balance wasn't a phrase. Actually, the sort of the whole, you know, 80s, late 80s yuppie thing was still in full swing. The sort of work hard, make lots of money type sort of mentality was around, and it was a kickback against that. The idea of the magazine is that offices aren't very good places for you, not just in terms of just being a little bit kind of unhealthy places physically, but also for your creativity. And we're all familiar with the fact that when you stuck on something, if you go away and do nothing for a bit, or go and take a break, or just hang out, the idea comes, you know, a solution can come to your mind. So I suppose that is kind of emerging from that, really. It is championing the value of doing nothing and the importance of enjoying yourself. And that is as important as achieving. And that if you do something you love and you enjoy, you go and do it well. If you do something well, you'd be surprised at what can emerge from that, perhaps even a job. And that I did with Tom. It was his kind of inspiration, and he was bringing me in to kind of help with my experience of putting magazines together. But it was a very small team, and the two of us did it together for maybe 17 years, I think, as we were working on other things. And then I only stopped it. Well, actually, when we stopped doing it, it really emerged from taking a break. I mean, after 10 years of doing this magazine, which is quite a literary magazine, and there's a rich history of people arguing for the importance of leisure time and the value of stepping back from the daily grind. So there was like so much material to put in there. And it was championing the value of time out. And after we'd done it for 10 years, we thought, listen, we should practice what we preach and take a break after the 10 years of doing this. Because during that time, we'd also been working together on lots of commercial projects for The Guardian newspaper and Channel 4 TV. We were used to do help The Guardian newspaper come up with ideas for new sections and mock them up and everything. We used to help Channel 4 do posters, billboard posters for their documentary series. So we were doing kind of creative work that was commercial. 10 years of that, we thought, let's take a break. Let's take a sabbatical break each and go and just do something like different. And in my case, I didn't have a family then or anything. I had saved up money from doing all that commercial work. I thought, I'm going to go and live abroad. And I went to live in Rome. And that's really, it was my time in Rome, looking back on it, when the idea of the Cloud Appreciation Society was born.
I want to come back to that and talk about Rome, talk about the birth of the Cloud Appreciation Society. But I suppose just a couple more things on the magazine. How How did it feel to be doing something? You mentioned that work-life balance wasn't, it didn't really exist as a phrase, wasn't part of parlance. How did it feel to be doing something that was so countercultural at the time?
It felt fun. Tom's better at being rebellious than I am. So I think it worked because of the partnership we had going on. Tom's more a bit more anarchistic than I am. Do you know what I mean? I like everyone to be happy. We had fun. It really did feel countercultural. We had every time we did an issue, the issues were sometimes monthly, sometimes quarterly, depending on which sort of period of time we're talking. And we used to have a party every time there was an issue. And they were like legendary parties that just had really interesting people at, you know, so people like Louis Theroux was just starting out. He wrote for us right in the early days, and he would come and do stuff at our parties, really interesting performers at our parties. So it was a stimulating time, and I feel Tom was brilliant at just finding people, curating people. And so from my point of view, it was super stimulating to have that environment as my kind of work life. We had a little office together with a couple of people who were helping us in Holborn in the middle of London, and we would mix our time between doing the Idler and then doing stuff that was paid. And we were working quite hard, but it didn't really feel too much like that because we were having fun. And everyone said, oh, isn't it ironic you guys are doing so much at the moment and you do this magazine called The Idler. And it was a sort of the thing that everyone would say. And so if you literally sit around doing nothing the whole time, it gets a bit boring. And you have to, you know, depends on your mentality and your personality. But the really important thing is times of putting effort into something that you value, not into something that you're told to do or that you're just kind of putting your bum on a seat in an office to sort of, you know, because you feel that's what you ought to do. Putting effort into something you enjoy and then sort of carving out the break times from it so that's when ideas come in. You know, I talk about with the Cloud Appreciation Society, you know, that we sort of fight against blue sky thinking as a joke, but it's actually true. You can't get creative ideas by pushing away the distractions from life and putting yourself into this sealed kind of empty space where every idea, you know, like companies do, they go and they do blue sky thinking and every idea is valuable. We're all going to sit around. There's going to be no distractions because we'll go away somewhere and we're going to sit in a room. We're going to really deal with this issue and try and come up with some great ideas. I think that is the wrong way of coming up with original ideas. I think original ideas come from the distractions in life, embracing them and running with them and actually taking a break and doing something different, something that you enjoy, will bring connections that will help you solve whatever the problem is on your mind.
It's interesting, I suppose, that if the magazine were to be launched today, that DNA would probably be labeled under mindfulness or self-care, or those kinds of things, which have become very very popular, rightly so, but almost that's kind of come full circle, you know, to the extent that when you launched the magazine that they weren't a thing, and now with the Idler still going in a different kind of shape, those labels are being used more commonly.
Yeah, no, it almost overused and kind of a bit cliched, but I mean that's good. I think it's good to have awareness of that, of the importance of how mental health is something you can actively work to improve and sort of help protect by activities like mindfulness. But it was never a phrase when we were starting out. and the sort of spiritual side of things was never a big thing of the magazine. It was more countercultural and a little bit more anarchistic than that. But I mean, it's almost more of a question with the whole society and clouds, that that's a kind of mindful activity. But again, I've never used that term. Because I know deep down in my bones that these phrases come and go. And if I make it all a bit, you know, it's all about mindfulness, pretty soon everyone will be like, oh yeah, mindfulness, I've done that, a bit bored of that. But, you know, the clouds never go out of fashion, so just stick with them.
Let's talk about Rome. You said you didn't have any family there. You just sort of had saved up some money. So why Rome?
I had a girlfriend who was Italian, Christina, and so I'd learned some Italian. Wasn't very good, but enough to get by. And I liked the Italian mentality, or at least my stereotypical impression of it. Which I think does sort of, it's like quite a nice yin to the English mentality's yang. Do you know what I mean? It's like a sort of opposite, more, you know, I get, it's all cliches, do you know what I mean? But to me, I like when the Italian people I've met, Rome as a city seemed to me the right size. So it was big enough to have stuff going on. Culturally small enough to walk around the heart of without much difficulty, cosmopolitan enough to feel that there were going to be interesting people to meet. And so it didn't seem too difficult a place to, for me to choose the city I wanted to go to. And I had, I did an apartment swap with my apartment in London. I put an ad in an English-speaking magazine in Rome. This is before, like, anyone much sort of was going on in terms of internet, with like websites. It wasn't really, you do it all online now. But then I put an ad in the magazine. I said, I want to live in this one. I've got a flat in London. I want to do a flat swap. I want to live in this one area of Rome called Trastevere. And I want to be from this month to this month, maybe 6, 7, 8 months, something like that. I got one reply. The person said I got a flat in Trastevere and I'd like to do the swap, and it all worked out. It was obviously destined. It was meant to happen. So I went over there, and it was, I lived opposite a little bakery. It was a little cobbled street in this medieval part of Rome, upstairs from an English bookshop, and just had the best time when I was there. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. That part of Rome is, as you say, it's sort of cobbled, narrow streets, and you know, you explore, wander around, and you're, one minute you think it's a dead end, and the next it opens up and you're in a beautiful square with churches on the other side, which have amazing art inside of them as well. So it's, yeah, I can imagine why you wanted to base yourself there.
And I didn't have big plans for my time there, which was interesting because, you know, we're so used to having a routine, we're so used to having a goal that you're trying to get, achieve, something you're trying to sort of, some reason for being, do you know what I mean, that relates to your activity. And while I was there, I'm just going to try and learn a bit of Italian, meet some people, have a nice time, and just coast for a bit to take a break, because we really had worked quite hard. And although it was enjoyable stuff, it just felt like it was a sort of little moment, a changing time. And it's funny how that's both brilliant and alarming to have no routine any longer. When before I was like, I might get on my bicycle, cycle across London, go to the office each day. You know, we had all stuff, a lot of stuff planned out. Suddenly to go somewhere and just, what am I going to do today? Sounds amazing. And it is amazing at first because you're on holiday at first. It feels like you're on holiday. And then you've been on holiday for a while. And then, okay, so what am I going to, you know, okay, I'm going to go start going to some Italian lessons, you know, start going around and seeing the amazing architecture of this city, start kind of exploring the art. But you have to start bringing in different kind of routines in a way. And then there's space in your life. Space mentally, space psychologically, that's great in over time, but in the short term, that takes some getting used to. And I think that space was really, that space was what ultimately, you know, you fill a space after a while. You have a space and you're like, I'm in a different place now. What am I going to do when I get back? Where am I going to go? You don't really know. You don't come up with any ideas, but that space has allowed sort of thoughts to come along, which then kind of crystallize once you get back.
Earlier, you sort of alluded to the fact that Rome was, if not the birthplace of the Cloud Appreciation Society, certainly the first place where it kind of came into your mind. How did that happen?
Because of what was missing in the sky, in a way. In Rome, you do get fantastic clouds at certain times of year, these huge storm clouds growing very tall in the sky, and they let down an absolute torrent of heavy rain at certain times in the summer. But a lot of the time, I would look out the window in the morning and it would be another completely blue sky with no features up above. And I began to feel that something was missing in a funny sort of way. I like the fact that here in the UK, people do complain about there being too many clouds around, but each day is a new page to read with the sky. It is varied each day, and from one moment to the next, and I wasn't getting that in Rome. I was loving the fact that it was warm, and I was thinking, you know, oh, it's another great sunny day. And after a while, if we had that here in Britain, and it was sunny, just sunny blue sky the whole time, for the first month, 2 months, everyone would be going, hey, it's like Rome, or it's like the south of France. And then after a while, I think people would start to miss something. They would start to miss, and they would like, what would it be? They would be they'd be missing the variety, the variance of the sky, and the fact that the clouds are an expression on the face of the atmosphere, one that's changing the whole time, and that you can read the moods of the atmosphere. And I think that's so ingrained into our DNA, into our sense of place and sense of nature here, that might take a little bit of time to put your finger on what was missing, but I think that would soon ultimately you'd get to that. So that was what was missing in Rome. But then there was also, you know, there was a sense in which it was stimulating from a cloud point of view, because you go inside every church and the frescoes on the ceiling of these Baroque churches, the Baroque interiors or Renaissance paintings would, particularly actually Baroque, but they would have these clouds that were serving a kind of symbolic purpose of giving you a vision through them up into heaven. You would have them as the things that were there for the apostles and the saints to recline upon and look down. There were the sofas of the saints up on the ceilings of these churches. So I was interested in the fact that those clouds did have this symbolic role, one that maybe changed once we were able to eventually go up into the sky and get in a hot air balloon and see that there weren't any angels perched on top of a cloud. But before that time, we always looked up to our gods. You look up to the gods, you're looking up in the sky, you see clouds, you associate them with the deities. And so they featured in the religious paintings of Rome. So these things are all swirling around in my mind. As I was reading books, as I was kind of just exploring, I didn't think about anything to do with the society there. That all happened once I came back. But I'm just saying it was all gestating, I think you could say.
So during those early musings, did you give any consideration to whether or not there may be other people around the world with a similar love or passion for clouds?
I did chat to people around Rome, and I did start, you know, saying, I think clouds are an interesting thing, because people sort of love them and hate them. And anything that people love and hate has legs. One thing that I did with Tom back in the days of doing The Idler was we imported this very strong alcohol called absinthe, which was a very controversial act. This was in 1998, before anyone had imported it into the UK since the 20s. This was the alcohol that was very infamous in France and Belgium and Switzerland. It was what Van Gogh was supposed to have chopped his ear off under the influence of. There were lots of, you know, stories about absinthe being hallucinogenic and so on. And we thought it was interesting. Someone wrote an article for the magazine about it, and we ended up going into business with him and importing it. The first people to bring it in made a big fuss, because there was an equal number of people saying this is brilliant and an equal as there were people saying this is awful. And the from our point of view, it was like a sort of art statement almost, because it was banned for all the wrong reasons. All these reasons that were to do with kind of lobbying from the wine industry and the more conservative parts of Parisian society, because it was in the Parisian avant-garde, didn't like the idea of women being drunk, all this sort of stuff, banned for all the wrong reasons. The point I'm making here, though, was this mix of people against, for it and against it, meant that it was a subject that people talked about, and it was in every newspaper when it came out, and, you know, all over the media. And then lots of other people started importing it afterwards, and then we started getting it made for us outside Paris and blah 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 blah. That was still slightly ringing in my ears when I started thinking about clouds, because I thought people complain about them, and yet stop someone and ask them what they think about clouds, and they go all a bit dreamy, a bit nostalgic. And they go, oh yeah, well, yeah. I know we talk about someone having a cloud hanging over them, there being a cloud on the horizon. But I kind of like them. I find them, I remember looking at finding shapes in the clouds when I was a kid, and I think there's something dreamy about them. They look a bit wistful. So I knew that there was this sort of tension there that interested me in a sort of, in the most kind of abstract way.
Did you deliberately set out to start a society and bring together cloud lovers around the world?
No. I came back from Rome feeling like, what am I going to do now? I've got to get my act together. And I was like, go back to doing The Idler with Tom. Slightly felt like I was sort of time to do something different. And a friend of mine, Kathy, was starting a literary festival in Cornwall down in Port Elliot. It's called the Port Elliot Literary Festival. And she said, why don't you, you know, I'd been kind of talking quite a lot about clouds since I got back, saying I'm going to do something with them. I'm not quite sure what. I'm sort of interested. I think they're interesting. I always like the sky. Going on about it. She said, well, why don't you do a talk for the festival about clouds? And I said, well, I haven't written a book or anything. It's not like I'm could be in a literary festival. In fact, I've never given a talk. And she said, well, I'm sure you do it well because you talk well about them. And doesn't matter if you haven't done a book, we're desperate for speakers. So I agreed to that. And I thought, The idea of the society emerged from that talk, because I thought I'd give it an unusual name, and because it would make people more likely to come along. So I called it the inaugural lecture of the Cloud Appreciation Society, just to make it sound weird and intriguing, because I thought, I actually didn't know what a talk like that would have in it, but I knew that it's a talk I'd like to go along to. So I thought I'll give it that name and I'll work out what to put in it. That's how it started, because everyone who came along to the talk, and quite a lot of people did come because they obviously, it resonated for them in the same way. They said, how do I join your society? And I thought, oh, I should actually have a real society, actually, now I think about it, because it's sort of such a, it's like a sort of such a funny idea, but actually sometimes the more flippant ideas can have a lot of weight to them.
Was that a surprise that people, you know, wanted to join this thing that didn't exist yet?
Yeah, it was. And it, what was a funny thing, a surprise as well, is if you say, you know, here's a society and I'm member number one, and I've started this society, almost the next day, you're in a position of authority. It's really weird, do you know what I mean? Because you're the person who, you run the Cloud Appreciation Society. Yeah, and just about half an hour ago, I came up with that idea. So there's something that's quite interesting in itself. When something has a name, it becomes a reality. And that's almost what the talk was. It gave a name to something. And then when that name was out there, suddenly those amorphous ideas I'd had when I was in Rome, those sort of feelings of this is interesting, love-hate thing, you know, there's so much to do with clouds because of this cameo role they've played throughout human culture. They've always been there in the background. All those sort of amorphous thoughts and ideas suddenly become crystallized when there's a name. And so that really was a really important little kind of pivotal point. And then it was just, okay, well, we do need a society in appreciation of clouds, because we do need to be reminded of this thing. We need to be reminded of the fact that the sky is something to pay attention to. Because the funny thing is, once something is in your vision the whole time, you become blind to it. And the sky is half of our vision all the time. But we've evolved to pay attention to what's happening down on the ground, because that's where our food is, that's where danger is, that's where community is, that's where your mate is, that's where your children are. Do you know what I mean? So evolutionarily, it makes a lot of sense. But it's funny that it's half our visual sphere, the sky.
Yes.
If someone taps us on the shoulder and says, look at what's going on up there, what do you think of that? You're going to go, oh, God, it's beautiful, it's amazing. Wow, actually, now that I look at it, and look how it's changing, and look how the light is reflecting off it, and so there's, you know, as the sun's going down, how the colours of it are changing. It's like nature's abstract art, but you have to be reminded. You have to be tapped on the shoulder, because it's not sort of in our DNA to pay attention to the sky. And I realised that's what the society does, or could do. It could be that tap on the shoulder for people, and a really valuable tap on the shoulder, because as you engage with this part of nature, there are lots of benefits, a little bit like that stuff with the Idler magazine. Those benefits of disengaging from the stresses and strains of terra firma, lifting your perspective from your kind of, or the urgent stuff you have to do down here, or all the things you're stressed about or depressed about. Physically looking up is a symbolic shift in your perspective. There are lots of ways that could be interesting, but it really, from the start, all it started out as was, clouds are beautiful, and once you start thinking about them, they're absolutely fascinating things.
The tap on the shoulder analogy that you mentioned, I think, is a really interesting one. I listened to your TED talk where you went one step further than talking about clouds as, you know, nature's abstract art, and said they're quite reflective of the Rorschach test, which is the sort of abstract art that psychologists will give to people and ask what they see and then try and work out what that might be. So for me, it feels like you're saying to people, look up and see what you can see, but not actually asking them to see a certain thing. There's this thing going on, and it's up for you to be able to interpret that in the way that you see fit.
Yeah, and the brilliant thing is that everyone has a relationship with the sky, and each person's relationship with the sky is different. I mean, we may forget to look up, we may forget to pay attention to the sky, but most of us have, when we were young perhaps, found shapes in the sky. Most of us have a connection to the sky, which, you know, because of that early time finding shapes in the sky, it's a connection that runs quite deep. And for that reason, you know, we have quite an emotional connection to the clouds and the sky. And for different people, it's different. They have a different relationship. But you could go anywhere in the world. You could meet someone who lived in Siberia, somewhere quite different, Mongolia. You could go and have a chat with a goat herder, and with the translator there, talk about the sky. You would both have equal amounts of reference to that. You would both be able to talk about what was interesting, what you liked about it, know exactly probably what each other was talking about, and you pick a lot of other subjects, that's not going to be the case.
Mm.
Both each person has their own personal relationship with the sky, and at the same time, it's universal. We all inhabit the same sky. We all share the atmosphere. And the formations of the clouds do vary in some ways around the world, but it's the same vocabulary, because the same formations are happening, just the phrasing and the frequency of that vocabulary will change from place to place. And sometimes in some places the sky is much quieter, in some places it's booming, but it's the same language, the language of the clouds the world over.
It's been 15-ish years. Do you feel that what you're doing is more relevant now to today's world than when you started the society?
Absolutely. I feel that I feel more excited by the society now than ever. And it's been fascinating to watch how this bringing together of people around the world has evolved. As different nations have kind of got more into the idea as well. It started off being a very UK thing. And now there's so much activity in the States. It's really taking off in America. And then over the last year, the third most traffic for the website has come from China. Randomly, even though the website's in English. And so it's really interesting to observe that, which is really an expression of this fact that it's universal. I think that the divisional nature of the digital world, the way in which it polarizes people, and how that is then expressed in politics, I think the two are connected. That has made it more relevant now. Our increasing addiction to devices, the magnetic pull of our devices has made it more relevant. when I was young, sitting at the bus stop in London waiting for a bus, there was nothing to do. If you didn't have a book with you, you were looking at the looking across the road at people walking by. You're just sort of staring into the middle distance. That's all time when your brain's doing something. Your brain is as active when you're just daydreaming as it is when you're concentrating on a task. If you look at it in an fMRI scanner, it's consuming as much energy. Something's going on. and, you know, the general belief is it's sort of organizing things on a subconscious level, rearranging things, getting rid of some stuff that's not important, and sort of maybe firming up some memories that are, making connections between things that weren't obvious at first. That is where ideas come from. That is where creativity comes from. And we have lost those gaps in our day because of devices. Because now when you're sitting at the bus stop, you're flicking through your emails, taking a look at the news, what's happening, you're updating something in your social media. You're in the kind of concentrating part of your brain, not in the vacant, staring at nothing part of your brain. So that idle mode of our minds has been edged out. And I think that the sky and cloud spotting is a way that legitimizes that. You know, it legitimizes doing nothing to look at the sky. You're doing something and doing nothing at the same time. That is as valuable now as ever, if not more so. And then this kind of unifying nature of the sky, how people, when they can be opposed to each other in so many ways, you know, how many people are going to say, I really hate sunsets. And there's nothing I hate more than a sunrise. Not many, you know. It is a bit of a basic common feeling of, you know, look over there behind you, the beauty of the sun lighting the clouds in that golden, those golden rays with the sort of ruby tinges to the edges of them and the shaded side facing towards us, gilding those stratocumulus clouds. It's calming. It's universally something that we know is valuable because it is so transient, because it is momentary. It's only going to be like that for a minute. Clouds are the embodiment of the ephemeral, and for that reason they're eternal.
So Gavin, we're now going to play Somerset Who's Who, which is a game where I'm going to give you the names of people who have a Somerset connection and two identities, and you have to tell me which one you think is their real identity.
Okay, sounds good.
So I've got five names, and then for each of them, I'll give you option A and option B, and you have to tell me which one you think is correct.
Go for it.
So your first name is David Lux. So was David Lux A, a former Bishop of Wells, or B, a hockey goalkeeper for Great Britain in the 1990s?
David Lux. He's got to be the hockey goalkeeper.
That's correct.
Nice.
Off to a good start. Your next name is Eleanor Duckett. So, was Eleanor Duckett A, a historian and author specialising in the Middle Ages, or B, a biologist known for her work with lichen?
Well, I mean, Eleanor Duckett sounds like a historian to me.
It's correct again.
Nice.
Two out of two. I don't know what we were worried about.
I'm relaxing into it now.
All right, all right. Name three is Ralph Allen. Was Ralph Allen A, an entrepreneur known for his reforms to the postal system, or B, a missionary who translated the Bible into the Ethiopian language of Ongota?
That is a very difficult one. Can you give me his name again?
Ralph Allen.
Ralph Allen. Ethiopian translator.
He's the entrepreneur.
Okay.
I was quite pleased with that.
Yeah, that was, maybe you were trying too hard with that one. I should have.
All right.
Yeah, okay.
Number four is Claire Calvert. Was or is Claire Calvert A, a mixed media artist from Axbridge, or B, a ballet dancer who is the first soloist at the Royal Ballet?
mixed media artist.
She's the ballet dancer.
Yeah. See, I started well, but
I know.
I'm losing my form now.
So you're 2 out of 4, so you're on...
You've got one more to go.
One more to go.
Really, this is going to be the decider about whether I'm over halfway
exactly.
right or not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Your final name is William Harbutt. So, was William Harbutt A, the archaeologist who discovered the Bronze Age hill fort at Norton Fitzwarren, or B, the inventor of plasticine?
William Harbutt was absolutely and definitely the hill fort historian.
William Harbutt invented plasticine.
Oh.
But I love your confidence.
Well, I didn't know plasticine was invented in Somerset. That's a revelation to me. And, you know, the Somerset Tourist Board should be making a much bigger deal about that. Where's the Somerset Museum of Plasticine? Do you know what I mean?
That is a good question.
Wow.
It is a good question. Before we go, where can people find out more about you, your writing, the work you're doing, the society, and maybe understand a little bit more about what being a member looks like?
The society is easily Googleable, Cloud Appreciation Society. You get to the website, you can join there, and that's hopefully fairly straightforward. We have an app called Cloud A Day, Cloud-A-Day, and that is useful, free app, cross-platform. You can use that to look at the different cloud types, learn the different types. Got a little AI element to it. Take a picture of the sky and it'll tell you what cloud it thinks you're looking at. And we do a weekly Facebook live video on a Monday. So that's an opportunity to hear some interviews and some discussion about different cloud formations. When you become a member, you get a certificate with your name on it and you get a badge and you get this funny little wheel thing called a cloud selector, which you turn and it shows you the different types. It's one of those old, like, you know, in the 50s, it was the equivalent of apps in the 50s, you know, you turn the wheel and it shows you different stuff in the different windows, different information. But you also, as a member, get a cloud a day. And this, we were talking before about the society being like a tap on the shoulder. This is the digital tap. The cloud a day is an email that arrives in your inbox every morning. And that may sound horrific to people at first thought, but actually that email is tiny. It's an image from one of our members around the world, or perhaps of a painting, or and it's a short paragraph of text explaining what's happening in the sky, or perhaps explaining what that artist was trying to do and why they painted that in the sky. Perhaps a quotation. That is the little moment before your day begins, before the chaos of the day starts, for you to remember, yeah, the sky is something that as this day progresses, I'm going to engage with just for a moment or two at one point. I'm going to spend a moment with my head in the clouds, even if it is a passing moment, because I know deep down that to have your head in the clouds every now and then helps you keep your feet on the ground.
Gavin, I'm delighted that we were able to meet on this beautiful evening and get your insight into the clouds around us today and everything else that was going on. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a delight talking to you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.